The Killing Type, a novel by Wayne Jones, Chapter 6. Sometimes a mystery in real life can be solved by studying fictional ones, and there is the added benefit to me in that such research satisfies a scholarly urge which has lain unaroused for well over a year now. How the time flies. I get up early on a brisk Friday morning, walk to my neighborhood coffee place. They've called it, alas, the coffee place since 1984, and sit for about a half hour with the Globe and Mail, a latte, and an exquisite cranberry scone before I set to planning my strategy for the day. Once the last crumbs of news and biscuit have been consumed, I sit for a moment or two and watch the traffic hurrying by. Whence and to where, I wonder. A young girl, also right there out on the sidewalk, standing still, underdressed for this weather, but standing quite still, looking up at the sky. Distractions. I decide that I will spend some time digging out information about the Canadian mystery novel. Where did it come from? Where has it gone? What is it at all? I exit the place just as an old man enters whom I recognize but just cannot identify. He nods affectionately and pauses ever so briefly, apparently expecting me to do the same. Not wanting to prolong the awkwardness, I point at my watch in a vague attempt to indicate a pressing appointment, and he seems genuinely pleased. He is babbling something or other as I step out onto the street, and the door whooshes closed behind me. It's a short walk to the library, and I luxuriate in it even more as a brisk wind pushes at my back. The sun is out, too, and I have to squint when it peeks from behind clouds occasionally. The library is modestly crowded, just the way I like it. I find out that the first crime fiction by a Canadian was a novel now known as The Mysterious Stranger by Walter Bates. It was published under that title in New Haven, Connecticut in 1817, and later in the same year, I believe, in London, England, under a cacophonous mouthful of a title beginning with Companion for Caribou and going on for nearly 100 words. Bates was in fact born in the United States, but he eventually moved to Canada and settled in Kingston, Ontario. The other writer with some claim to the title of first Canadian mystery novel was at least born in Canada, actually near Kingston, on Wolf Island, just a 15-minute ferry ride from the city across the mouth of the St. Lawrence River. His name is Grant Allen, and he published a collection of short stories entitled An African Millionaire, Episodes in the Life of the Illustrious Colonel Clay, London, 1897. One or two hundred years later, and the crime fiction which crowds the review pages of the newspapers is almost all American. The reviewers crow about the books being more than crime fiction. One is a brilliant history of a time and place. Another teaches some really important and useful lessons. And the plot of still another, I can go on, is woven with ancient lore. The only Canadian in the gaggle has apparently squawked out a book with a grisly setup and plenty of well-written gore. As a scholar, I don't know what to think. I don't expect anything like what might be called improvement in the course of literary history of any genre. Literature is not a moral adventure, a macrocosm of the story about starting from nothing and developing into something better. Joyce is not superior to Homer. He is just still writing about 3,000 years later. Still, I would have at least hoped that the state of the lowly mystery, crime fiction, the narratives of murder, I would have hoped that they would have not had degenerated into dullness and didacticism and mere bloodshed. Anything interesting I hear behind me, and at first my concentration prevents me from realizing that the question is directed at me. Andrew? I turn around and see Rachel gleaming in front of me. Perhaps it is the reading I have been doing all day, mysteries on mysteries, but I don't have the sudden joy I should have in seeing her again. Damn this impressionable head of mine, but the first thing I think about is how she could possibly know I would be there. Why is she following me around? Why is she spying on me? What is she up to that she needs to be sure that I am secured so that she can carry on with her nefarious activities? Hi, Rachel. Cold. Factual. The dear girl, not at all aware of the ridiculous machinations going on in my mind and positively brimming with a joie de vivre that I haven't experienced since my early halcyon days at Toronto U. The dear thing just smiles down on me, now squirming awkwardly in my seat. How goes the research? I'm taking a bit of a break today, sort of, I say as she makes her way around to where I am sitting and plonks herself down confidently on the low table. Sort of? Yes, just doing some research into murder generally, murder mysteries actually. I might suspect the girl for some unfounded fantastical reason, but she is disarming. What have you been up to? I dare, and before she can answer, it's quite a, well, coincidence meeting you here. No, not really, I guess. I mean, I often come down here to the university library, sort of like a busman's holiday thing, I guess. She chuckles. But I often come down here just to read some of the papers that we don't get at the public library, that kind of thing. So you're reading newspapers? Well, today, no, not today, actually. Just thought I'd have a look around. Somewhere now deep inside me, I do realize the utter inappropriateness of my interrogation of her. Even the thought of her being somehow involved in two murders is so outlandish as to defy reason. I relax and accept the fact that I am chatting with a friendly librarian. That sounds productive. She sits straight up on the table and fixes me with her eyes. Listen, she says, can I ask you something, or not so much a question, but could I offer something? Of course, but I'm not quite sure what you mean. It's simple, really. I'm not meaning to interfere with your work or anything. I have a lot of respect for any kind of research, especially research which can have practical results in real life. I do. I guess I'd just like to offer my services. She blushes. I mean to say, I know a lot about sources, and I just like to say that if you need any guidance in getting at those local sources, I'd be more than happy to help you out. That's all. Rachel, that's a very kind offer, and I will definitely take you up on it. If you can point me to a few things that would save me time, well, in fact, you've already done that when I've already been at the library, but if you could do that more, say, comprehensively, I'd be very appreciative. She beams again after her nervous offer and reaches into a little leather purse that she has strung over her shoulder. Here's my card, and I've taken the liberty of writing my home phone number on there as well. I hope you'll call. I'd love to help in any way I can. I take the card and nod to her to let her know that I will definitely call upon her. Well, she says, getting up, I should be going. She reaches her hand out awkwardly, and at first I think she has something else to give me until I realize that she's offering to shake. We do, and she scurries off. A funny thing happened as I sipped my skim milk cafe au lait later in the afternoon. I was barely aware of the bustle all around me as I pored over a stack of four or five books, some germane to my research and some, I confess, not. I was right in the middle of the room and I could sense something. The guy by the window was watching me. The cute kid of the earnest couple at the table next to me was poking through the book on forensic science that I had laid on the empty chair at my own table. And generally speaking, while I was concentrating on the more horrific details of murder and mutilation, I was still aware of orders being solicited in place, money received and change remitted, napkins, stirrers, and condiments taken and used at the little station just by the cash register. Suddenly I felt worried about nothing in particular. I didn't expect the guy by the window to lunge at me, or for the murderer who wanders the Nosting streets to burst through the door and shamelessly choose me as his next victim. It was nothing that specific. Rather, just a feeling, perhaps the result of too much criminal reading, or a personalization of the civic geist. Sometimes, no matter how dedicated one is to the task, no matter how diligent, how committed, the base fear which afflicts a whole city cannot be avoided. Later, at my favorite Cambodian restaurant, a hole in the wall where I eat weekly, I choose the number 14 and read a section of the Globe while the chef works his magic behind me. It occurs to me for the first time that I never really hear any sounds of cooking back there. No clanking of kitchen implements, no sizzling, dishes being clacked. I place my order. He always repeats the number back to me, and within about 5 minutes, a plate of freshly prepared food is gently slid in front of me. I enjoy the fact that most of the staff there, the nervous guy behind the counter, the friendly but efficient waiter, the woman who replenishes the jug of water, they all recognize me as a regular and, for example, don't put a knife and fork down as they do for others because they know I prefer chopsticks. There are many fewer people here this evening, and I imagine that is because either they are at home or in coffee shops discussing this horror, or frankly some of them are more scared to be out on the streets now. A neighbor whom I have nodded to a couple of times on leaving and returning home approaches me. "Nothing but bad news, I'm sure," he says, nodding his head down at the newspaper. "Yes, I suppose so. Hello, Tom. It is hard to believe, isn't it?" He stands there a little awkwardly, as if I've asked the wrong question or muffed my line. "Listen, I don't mean to be forward, but may I join you?" he eventually says. I have limited options, of course, and acquiesce with a muted yes. He sits, and when the waiter comes with my food, Tom predictably orders the pad thai, the equivalent of getting spaghetti and meatballs in an Italian restaurant, and selfishly on my part, I worry that the main result of his order being out of sync with mine is that mine will be cold while I defer eating out of courtesy. "Please eat," he says, and whether he means it or not, I dig in with my chopsticks, a piece of chicken flecked with chili, the sauce, chunks of fresh tomatoes for contrast, the delectable rice. "Who do you think did it?" I ask a little simplistically, not really expecting an answer but hoping to generate some conversation between mouthfuls. "God, I mean, do you really think there is someone here in town who could do something like that?" Well, the alternative is not too appealing either. A visitor, someone who just happens to be here, or maybe even worse, has made the trip here expressly to do this. Jesus. His pad thai arrives, looking rather bland in comparison to my half-finished wonder. The meal and the personal interaction are not quite the same after that, and I have to admit to wolfing mine down in an effort to escape him.